This is Jay Sekulow in Washington, D.C. It's Thanksgiving and a nation giving thanks for freedom.
Live from Washington, D.C.
This is my right.
Jay Sekulow Live.
Right given by God.
Phone lines are open for your questions right now.
Live a free life.
Call 1-800-684-3110.
Live in freedom.
That's 1-800-684-3110.
Talking about
welcome to the broadcast, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving. This is Gene Kapp along with Jay Sekulow, Chief Counsel of the American Center for Law and Justice. On this very special day, a nation does give thanks. Jay, we're a nation at war. We're a nation that is consumed with a lot of activity right now, but a very important day to set aside and to give thanks to the Lord, give thanks to God for all of the blessings that He has given us.
You know, Gene, we're looking at, we're here in Washington, D.C., of course, and you know, look, the fact is we do have a lot to be thankful for because our freedom is intact and God really has blessed this country. You know, when we say we're a nation founded under God, remember, we've traced that back not only to the Gettysburg Address, but also statements from Thomas Jefferson, also from President Washington, and the statement that we are endowed by our Creator with these rights that are inalienable. They are part of who we are. They are a gift from God to man, not from government to man. I think that's very, very important. And in looking at that overall, what you see developing, I think it's clearly the relevant fact here. What you see developing is a situation in America where our freedoms, our ability to worship is the hallmark of who we are as a people. And I think that's been very, very positive. And Gene, for those of us that live in the Virginia area and live in an area that where there's a heavy military presence and in Hampton Roads, and where one of our main offices are located in the Norfolk, Virginia, Virginia Beach area, it's got the highest military concentration of any place in the United States. And there you see it. You see these, you have women without their husbands, men without their wives, they're serving overseas. But they understand that that was what they signed up for, that they are here to protect freedom and liberty, what our founding fathers deemed to be so necessary that we broke our ties with England. And we do have a lot to be thankful for. And who would have ever imagined that this great country that has been blessed by God in so many ways would now be on the vanguard of protecting freedom, not just internationally, but even in our own midst, protecting our country from domestic problems that went in and really try to eliminate the very freedoms we cherish. You know, we live in a country that has, in the most part, the best system of government in the world, and I really believe that. I mean, it's not perfect. No system is. We have a tremendous system, though, of government. The founding generation had a real insight, and a lot of it based on the scriptures as to how government was supposed to operate and to protect the liberties and rights of mankind. Those have been great things, so we've got an awful lot to be thankful for. We need to continue to pray for our leaders, the president, the leaders of the courts, the leaders of the Senate, and let's continue to pray for our great country, and especially the men and women overseas defending our freedoms.
You know, when you look at the heritage of this country, Jay, and all the Thanksgiving really means going back to the Pilgrims, there has been a tremendous effort put forth by Americans during this time of year to give to others, to give to the less fortunate, to help those that cannot help themselves. That is also a very important part of American tradition, Jay.
It is as well, and we need to be reaching out to those in need. You know, one of the great things I think the president has done, and that is this faith-based initiative, allowing religious organizations, Christian charities, and others to reach the needs of the poor without the government bureaucracy involved, so that federal funds could get right to those who need them, and also that faith messages should not be excluded from participating in those funds and programs. I think that's been a great thing. I think as we look at Thanksgiving, this is the best of America when we see these kind of programs in play.
Thanksgiving also symbolizes the start of the Christmas holiday season in many parts of the country. And of course, Jay, we get a lot of questions here at the American Center for Law and Justice during the holiday season, whether it's the workplace, whether it's in the school setting. What is appropriate with respect to expressing your religious faith and to expressing your belief in God during this time, right?
Yes, absolutely. And we've got a wealth of information there on the website. I encourage people to go there. But you're right, it's Christmas. As soon as Thanksgiving is over, the Christmas season officially starts. And that's when we realize that we're in full gear, getting ready for the Christmas season. Although so far, as things are standing, things are going pretty well around the country. We're seeing nativity displays already going up. We're seeing governments understanding what they can and cannot do. And things seem to be going very well. A nativity scene displayed in a window of a retirement home or a apartment complex that receives government funding is not a violation of the law. Telling you can't say Merry Christmas would be a violation because they would be censoring your speech. You have the right to say Merry Christmas at Christmas time. You have the right to display a nativity scene. Jewish people have the right to display a Hanukkah menorah, and that's on, even if it's on government property, it's still private expression, and the Supreme Court has said that is protected speech.
ACLJ.org. That's the internet address. Stay with us. Much more ahead when we come back.
The American Center for Law and Justice is committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. Whether it's in court or on Capitol Hill, the ACLJ stands ready to defend the Constitution. So much of our future is tied to our past and the importance of such documents like the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Gettysburg Address. And so much of the work of the ACLJ is focused on protecting our freedoms, our Constitution. The ACLJ has prepared a booklet that includes these very important documents called The Foundations of Freedom. We want you to have this booklet free of charge. Call now, 1-877-989-2255. Get your free copy of The Foundations of Freedom today. That's 1-877-989-2255. And don't forget, the best way to stay up to date on the issues that matter most to you and your family, the ACLJ website, online at aclj.org. Now there's a great new way to stay in touch with the American Center for Law and Justice, ACLJ Wireless. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulo.
With ACLJ Wireless, you'll get special updates from me and be able to get critical information fast, right from your phone. And the best part, you're helping the ACLJ.
The ACLJ Wireless service, 10% of the proceeds from your monthly service go directly to support the ACLJ. Plus, if you sign up today, the ACLJ receives an additional $10 at no extra cost to you. Choose from the most popular phones. Flexible and affordable calling plans starting at $29.99 with every 6 month of service free. And keep your existing cell number.
By using ACLJ Wireless, you're helping the ACLJ stand up for your rights.
ACLJ Wireless Service from ACLJ Member Services. Call now. 1-800-311-2501. That's 1-800-311-2501. Or online at acljwireless.com.
This is my right.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. Gene Kapp along with Jay Sekulo, Chief Counsel of the American Center for Law and Justice. On this Thanksgiving, we are taking your phone calls at 1-800-684-3110. That's 800-684-3110. Let's go to the phones now. Joe is on a cell phone with us now in Colorado. Welcome to the broadcast, Joe. Go ahead, please.
Hello, I just got one question. We vote people into office, and they're supposed to make the laws by what is written in our Constitution, by our founding fathers, the way the country was set up. Is there any way that the executive and legislative branch can push the Supreme Court to interpret the laws rather than create laws that we have to live by? After all, we pay the taxes.
Well, you know, in essence, you're right in this sense. We pay the taxes. The chief executive certainly works as the chief executive. The president is the chief executive of the United States. He works for the American people. And the difficulty is the Supreme Court, because of our systems of checks and balances, and I think this is an appropriate system, you have each branch of government able to check the other. Ultimately, though, and this is where I think you're correct in your analysis here, the Supreme Court is the final word on the issue of what is or is not constitutional. In other words, a statute passed by Congress, signed by the president, could still be voided by the Supreme Court of the United States if the Supreme Court decides that the provision of law is unconstitutional. And that was, of course, within the famous decision of Marbury versus Madison, giving the Supreme Court the right to check the co-equal branches of government. They're supposed to be co-equal, but the judiciary does carry a lot of weight, especially in the issues that we're concerned with. And what we need is judges and nominees that are appointed to the Court of Appeals, to the District Court, to the Supreme Court of the United States, that share a judicial philosophy where they're not legislating from the bench, rather interpreting law and its application, rather than legislating anew. That, of course, is the great challenge that we saw in Congress this year, especially in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where so many of the nominees by President Bush were denied access to even a full vote by the Senate. Now, I think the issue is going to be front and center, Gene, come January. It's clear that there's a major initiative here. And I'm also going to tell you that in the days ahead, there's going to be a major initiative. But the issue of judges is not going away. It is a key issue for us, and I think a key issue for the country, and one that, look, we mobilized tens of thousands of people around the country to stand up for these nominees, but we had a very difficult time. As you know, very few of these nominees, especially at the Court of Appeals, have gone through.
We're taking your phone calls right now at 1-800-684-3110. Let's go to Kansas now. Buzz is on the line with us. Welcome to the broadcast. What's your question for Jay, please?
Basically, we moved our church into a new facility. And when we went to the tax appraisal to get the tax-exempt forms for the property, they said I needed to go see the land use agent for the county. And when I went down and spoke with her, she said that we needed to obtain a special use permit for the church, for church activities. So that way, she said, so no inappropriate businesses could move in next door to us. When I talked to a few other people, and this is people at the state level, they said, well, maybe you have to pay, but maybe you don't. They're not really familiar enough with the Land Use Act, and I wasn't sure who else to go to that would be familiar with this type of thing. They want us to pay $200 to obtain this permit, and the thing is that I thought once we moved in there, you know, don't they have to abide by whatever laws are already in existence? Like if a church can't be within 500 feet of a liquor store or something like that, they can't allow a liquor store to move in there or an adult entertainment business or something like that, can they?
Well, that's really a zoning question more than a tax question. And the way the zoning laws have been set up in many counties, and I'm sure yours is the same, is they'll have restrictions where they will not allow what's called a sexually oriented business or an establishment that sells alcohol to be within 500 feet, 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, depends on the statute, of a church, any other religious group as well. It could be a synagogue, elementary schools. They try to keep a distance, a spread, if you will. Now, that is a zoning issue. The tax-exempt issue or the land-use special exemption is a different issue. You should, once you're in the location, the law should automatically apply. In other words, you usually don't have to apply for a special use when the law's already on the books. And clearly here it sounds like the law's already on the books. We need to get you in touch with our legal department here at the American Center for Law and Justice, because in reality, once you're in compliance with the zoning, which clearly you are, churches are allowed to operate in these kind of arrangements, the zoning law should then automatically be applied. There should not be a special process you have to go through in order to get the zoning laws to be applicable. So hang on the line here. Let me get our lawyers on the phone with you, and maybe what you've got is a misunderstanding of how these laws interact, but it sounds like there's some confusion. Let's see if we can get that rectified.
You know, in recent days, Jay, we are getting a lot of questions right along this line here with respect to this, the land use and what's appropriate and what's not with respect to churches.
You know what the reality is, Gene, and I hate to say it's a dollar and cents issue, but it is a dollar and cents issue. Cities and towns, counties looking for revenue anywhere they can get it. The idea that churches are tax exempt, the way that a lot of towns look at it is, well, gee, that's taking dollars out of the city's coffers. What used to be thought was that having a church, religious institution in the community would be a benefit to the community, would aid and assist the community, and that's why tax exemptions put it in the first place. Every county and city around the country basically has this, but it's not constitutionally required. You know, the Constitution doesn't require that religious organizations be tax exempt. It is the grace of government, so to speak, but it's the right thing to do, but it is a tax revenue question. We've had a number of cases. One we've successfully concluded in Arizona with a victory there, a complete cave-in by the government officials there, going after churches, trying to get them to pay property tax, and a good result there. But again, a number of these breaking out throughout the country.
Sam on the line with us now in New Jersey. Welcome, Sam. What's the question for Jay?
Yes, I'm a deacon in my church, and I wanted to witness at some of the area malls, but I want to witness, and our group would like to pass out tracts. And I'm wondering what laws or stipulation may or may not prevent us. I haven't contacted the mall yet. I wanted to talk with you first.
Well, the first thing to do is to contact the mall authorities to see what their policies and procedures are with regard to the distribution of literature. Most malls are private property, and private property owners, even when it's a shopping mall, have the right to regulate their properties so that if they do not want a particular activity taking place, they can say that. So it's going to be strictly dependent upon how the mall views the property. I know there are some shopping centers which are very open to free speech activities. That's especially true in California, where the state constitution provides additional free speech protections over and above the First Amendment. So it's really dependent upon the mall and the mall ownership. And it's, I will tell you, most malls do not allow the private distribution of literature.
Absolutely right, Jay. Phone lines open for your questions right now, 1-800-684-3110. Jim is on a cell phone with us now, calling from Kentucky. Welcome, Jim. What's the question for Jay, please?
Good afternoon, Jay. I was calling to inquire as to what legal action can be taken to protect a father's rights in a fetus so that a woman cannot have an abortion without her the father of the fetus's permission.
You know, this is increasingly becoming, Jim, a major issue, and you're seeing some cases develop on it. So far, the case law, though, has not supported the father of the child, unfortunately, to basically giving the child no protection from the father's standpoint and not giving the father a say-so. Now, there is a case that just came out involving an attack where a woman used force to protect her unborn child from harm, and she was deemed to be an appropriate defense of a third person, the third person being the unborn child. But the case law has not developed very well for fathers of an unborn child to protect their rights. So it's been difficult. The law has not caught up yet. There are some groups that are trying to push through some legislative remedies. I'm not so sure that it's a legislative remedy. I think more what you have to do is win the conscience and the heart and minds of the American people on this. And that's going to take compassion. It's going to take time. And it's going to take a real concentrated effort. So the law just has not been very good on that issue.
Let's go to California now. Karen is with us on the phone. Karen, welcome to the broadcast. Go ahead, please.
Thanks so much. I've heard you address the issue of religious clubs meeting on public campuses, but what I'm wondering is, do they have a right to meet on private school campuses?
So you've got a situation where your daughter's attending a private school, is that correct?
She's attending a private school, and they celebrate. We take off.
Well, let me jump right in here to help you out. If she's at a private school, if there's a policy that allows the students to meet, to have Bible studies or prayer groups, if they allow other groups to meet, you cannot, under the First Amendment, compel a private school to recognize a Christian club, for instance. In other words, as a private school, you make a decision whether you want your child to go there. If you don't, the answer is, and this sounds very tough, if you will, and I don't mean it to be, is if the school's doing things you don't like, the best thing to do is go to another school, because you can't compel a private school, because they have autonomy to recognize a group, be it religious or otherwise. You just can't compel that. So, Karen, when you're dealing with a private school situation, that's the way the law is. You can't compel them, nor should you be able to, a private school, to recognize a religious group or religious meetings.
The fact is there are important legal distinctions, Jay, when it deals with a private school and a public school system.
And the biggest one is the First Amendment applies to a public school, a government school, and it does not apply to the private school setting.
Let's go to Oklahoma. Summer is on the line. Go ahead, Summer. Your question for Jay, please.
Yes, I was calling for clarification about the religious disparagement in school curriculum. I was wondering if that applies even if no one in the class is of that religion, and also if that applies to Native American religions, which are often disparaged in public schools.
It applies to all religions, whether someone in the class or not. This came up in the context of a call we had the other day on the broadcast, where there was a discussion about a particular curriculum that really put Christianity in a bad light and an inappropriate light. And the concern there was, of course, it was disparaging to Christianity. But the same would be true whether it was involving Judaism, whether it was Native American, Indian, whatever religious faith it might be. You can't disparage. You can talk about what religious groups believe, but to disparage a religion is something that's inappropriate. The school should not show hostility to religion. It rather supposed to be neutral.
Stay with us. More when we come right back.
At the American Center for Law and Justice, we're dedicated to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. And now there's a new way you can stand with the ACLJ.
ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow with news about an important new way to stay in touch with the ACLJ, the ACLJ wireless service.
With an ACLJ wireless phone, you'll get special updates from me straight to your phone. And the best part, you're helping the ACLJ.
10% of the proceeds from your monthly service go directly to support the ACLJ. Plus, if you sign up today, the ACLJ receives an additional $10 at no extra cost to you. There's flexible and affordable calling plans. ACLJ Wireless, the latest member benefit that saves you money as you support the ACLJ. Other services include digital phone service, DSL for faster internet, and DirecTV. Call ACLJ Member Services, 1-800-311-2501. That's 1-800-311-2501. Or online at aclj.org/benefits. Sarah Sloan, a journalism student at an Arizona college, needed help. She received a failing grade on a writing project. The reason? Her Christian faith played too great a role in her writing.
I was completely shocked. I couldn't imagine that would happen, especially for a school setting.
Sarah turned to the American Center for Law and Justice and contacted the ACLJ online at aclj.org. ACLJ attorneys got to work fast, and they got results.
I received a call right back almost immediately from Eric Zimmerman, and he helped me right away.
The college reversed its discriminatory decision, and Sarah received the certificate she was earlier denied.
And it was very exciting because I know that without the ACLJ, I wouldn't have received my certificate. It really helped a lot.
Log on to the website at the American Center for Law and Justice, aclj.org. A great place to get valuable resource information and the help you need from the American Center for Law and Justice. Online at aclj.org. a website that makes a difference.
You are listening to Jay Sekulow Live. Gene Kapp here along with Jay Sekulow, Chief Counsel of the American Center for Law and Justice. Phone lines open at 1-800-684-3110. Taking your phone calls right now, let's go to Michael on the line with us in California. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the air.
I was listening to an earlier segment just on the radio, and the lady sounded very frustrated that she was not able to get a school program, after school actually, club to meet. And we had the very same frustration at the middle school 2 years ago. We met with the principal. A youth minister came with me. The principal had all these excuses. What we did the next year is we had several students, three students, formed a student club themselves. The public school allows other clubs to form and meet on campus during school and after school. And the kids had trouble to get a teacher to be the sponsor. And we just wrote a short note. The kids signed, 10 or 20 of them signed, asking a teacher, would you please be our sponsor of our student faith club? We finally got a teacher, and what happened was the kids meet every lunchtime, once a week during lunch. They can invite a guest speaker in.
That's great.
Sign in, come in, you can talk. My wife and I would go once a month and play music. We even invited the Christian Youth Theater to do two or three plays during lunch, even a Christmas play. And
this shows, Michael, that if you utilize the laws and the regulations that are out there, you can really have an impact on the public school campus. And while sometimes it's frustrating, you're right, we get calls about this all the time, the ability of these after-school club groups to meet. The fact of the matter is that during the lunch hour, during non-instructional time, you can meet, these students can meet as well. And also, the Supreme Court's very, very consistent with their situation in allowing them to meet. What has been the reaction of your school administration now that you've been meeting for a while?
Well, as it turns out, that there's two nice, the administration is not too gung-ho, but there are two ladies in the school principal's office, the secretary and another counselor, who are very eager to support us, and they do a little bit of interference, and we've had a number of other teachers that came during their lunch period to help supervise.
Well, if you get the support of the administration, that makes all the difference in the world on this. And the first thing that we encourage people to do in dealing with this kind of situation is when you want to have a religious groups meeting on campus, when you want to see an after-school club, especially in the middle school grades, the thing that we encourage people to do is to contact the school administration. That's the first thing. Don't assume they're the enemy. Talk with them first. Get a sense of what their questions or confusion might be. And they may be very supportive, like in a situation you talked about, once they got all the information. Here, what we want to encourage people to do is use the website. We've got great information on ACLJ.org, and we could really see this move forward aggressively and some good results, I expect.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Michael. Let's go to Idaho now. Tricia is on a cell phone there. Welcome, Tricia. What's up? What's your question for Jay?
Yes, I have a problem with a major retailer that I shop for. Actually, there's a couple of them that I shop for groceries, and they have some pretty racy magazines right up there by the checkout, right where my kids can see them. Is there anything I can do to get the store to move those?
Have you talked to anybody at the store about the consideration that they've got material that's inappropriate for minors and minors' reach, if you will, that every state and every county has a statute that says you cannot contribute to the delinquency of the minor without facing the risk of at least a misdemeanor? Have you talked with any of the store ownership or managers yet?
Well, I didn't realize that it would apply. So,
in other words, you've got a major grocery store chain here. I don't want to know the name of it. It's a major chain of a retail store. They've got magazines. Is this in a rack where kids have access, can actually see it?
Oh, yes. It's in the checkout.
Well, they should not be doing that. And when you've got a situation like that, if it is really what's deemed to be, even if it's not obscenity, but if it's pornography that might have some type of constitutional protection, albeit limited, you cannot have a situation where kids have access to it. In other words, even if they had, Playboy magazine, which is not considered to be pornographic these days, although, that's anybody can have opinions on it. The fact of the matter is, to a minor, they should not have access to that material. And if you're allowing access to that material, that is contributing to the delinquency of a minor. So it's certainly not the cutting edge right now of the pornography fight, because so much of the concern is leveled at what's coming into your house via your computer. But it's still legitimate, and I would complain to management. You certainly can bring your business elsewhere, and that's another way of handling it.
Yeah, you were in South Carolina last week, Jay, talking with federal prosecutors and some that have been tasked with the job of to deal with online pornography prosecutions.
Yeah, these are actually even going broader than that. It wasn't just the prosecutors, it was also some of the investigatory agents from the FBI. Interestingly, and this is, I think, something important here to point out, and I want to mention this. one of the things that has developed is, and we've had these calls come in time after time after time, about if I get material sent to my house, it is inappropriate material in my view, it is sexually explicit, I don't want to get it, what can I do? And we say, go to the post office, fill out a form, and the government will actually issue what's the equivalent of almost like a cease and desist order so that the publisher will, within a few months, get you off this mailing list. I asked some of the postal inspectors that were there at this meeting at the Department of Justice, when someone does call and they're still on that list, they fill out the forms are issued, the letter goes out, but they're still on the list. Can you do anything, Postal Service? And you know what they said? They will pick up the phone and actually call the publisher and say, get this, I'm Inspector so-and-so from the Postal Service, get this person's name off your list. And you can imagine, if those businesses that are selling these materials get a call from a postal inspector, you can imagine how quickly those people are contacting their data processing people and having them removed from these various mailing lists. So, yes, the good news is you can get a real response here.
That's good to know. Let's go to Ohio now. Heather is on the line there. Welcome, Heather. Go ahead with your question for Jay, please.
Hello. I'm calling from a university in northeastern Ohio. I'm at a private university that's highly academic, and I've been a student here for, this will be my fourth year, and I've served as a resident assistant on campus for 3 years. And this year, I'm what's called a senior resident assistant, and I have my own building on campus that I kind of oversee and make sure the girls are okay. However, just recently, I received an email saying that on November 7th, I will have to attend a meeting or a panel discussion to discuss transgendered issues. And this is a mandatory program that all residence life staff will have to attend.
Right. It's called diversity training is really what it is, Heather. It's a form of diversity training on your campus.
And last night I attended a meeting that we have every month on campus. And the meeting is for all the RAs in the area. And we were kind of misled by the meeting. We thought that the meeting was going to be discussing just our residence life issues. However, we got to the meeting and there were a group of students from Allies, and that is the group on campus that supports the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender group on campus. We had an hour-long meeting with them, and they were trying to get us to understand their beliefs and understand why they promote what they promote, and they were trying to gain our acceptance.
When you said you were compelled to attend, you were compelled. I understand that, you know, it's a private school, so they can require things that a public school university could not. Compelled to attend is one thing. Compelled to support is another. Have they gone that far, Heather, and said you must support this work?
Yes, they've actually. After the meeting that we had with Allies, they told us after the meeting, they asked, we want to discuss having a mandatory floor meeting in every building on campus for all of the people who live here. And we are wanting your feedback on whether or not we should make it mandatory for all students to attend a meeting about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered issues. They asked our opinion on whether or not we thought it should be mandatory. However, they did say at the meeting that they wanted to not let everyone know what the meeting they'd be attending would be about.
Well, there, you know, that's, you know, academic freedom on campus is supposed to be truth in advertising, so to speak. And Heather, what I would say, I'm going to get you in touch with our legal department here at the ACLJ to get you some help, and specifically to get you help on this topic. It's one thing to be required at a private school to go to an event. It's another thing to have to be able to support it. You can't be held to violate your right of conscience. Hang on the line here. We're going to get you some direct help on this.
Thanks for calling, Heather. Also, some information on the website, too, aclj.org. At the American Center for Law and Justice, we remain dedicated to protecting your constitutional and your religious freedoms. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.